This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Charlene Fontaine, founder and executive director of the Flying Tigers 69th DRS Association. In the news, we update the search for MH370 4 years after its disappearance and look at a newly designated National Aviation Museum, flight training in the F-104 Starfighter, slow acceptance of ADS-B, and the selection of a new FAA administrator. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 493 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. I'm recovering from a very long weekend of a snowpocalypse and calls at 4 o'clock in the morning and stuff. So I may be a little bit out of it. And of course, tomorrow I'm getting up at 5 a.m. to go to Baltimore so I can hang out with the FAA and AUVSI for that other show at the FAA Symposium on UAS regulation.
Yeah, I'm really disappointed that I'm not joining you there, David, but we'll certainly hear about it on this week's UAV Digest podcast, and maybe you can give us a little brief rundown on the show next week. Also with us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. Hi, guys. Looking forward to a great show tonight. We have a guest that is going to talk about one of, I think, my top five most favorite aircraft. So really looking forward to tonight's show.
It's going to be good. I know. Also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase the Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hello, Max and co-host. Great to be here. And just like David, I had to suffer some bad weather this weekend here, too, in California. I was picking up snow and ice. Now, of course, I had to climb up to 5,000 feet to do that, but, you know, icing nonetheless.
Our other co-host, Rob Mark, who's senior editor at Flying Magazine, is off this episode. We'll look for him next week. Well, now it's time to introduce our guest for this episode. That's Charlene Fontaine. She's founder and executive director of the Flying Tigers 69th DRS Association. She's an advocate and speaker for veterans, youth, and trauma and brain injury folks. She speaks at air shows and conferences, schools, and reunions to inspire youth to learn history, honor our elders, and all those who serve our country. Charlene, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hi, Max. Hi, gentlemen. Good evening.
It's great to have you here. Now, you've consulted internationally for over 30 years, wide variety of corporate industries. You have film industry experience. You've written a number of books. You've spoken at schools and military bases and air shows and other places. You've flown different kinds of aircraft. What kind of a degree did you get that allows you to take up all of these pursuits? It's kind of a really wide variety of things, Charlene.
Oh, thanks, Max. Actually, I haven't flown any aircraft. I've been privileged to fly an aircraft and an open cockpit planes in the Midwest in Indiana. Friends of mine were air show and wing walkers, and so I got to participate with their planes. My degree is from Indiana University. It's in communications, major in psychology, minor in English minor. My love of all things that fly comes from my father.
Ah, and how did he influence you in that way?
When I was 4 or 5, my first gift from him being on a business trip was a gyroscope. Dad decided he wanted me to understand how aircraft flew. So when he explained it to me, I was all excited about it. It was like all things that went fast, planes, cars, and horses.
Oh, very good. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to be talking about the Flying Tigers Depot Repair Squadron, and we have some more things coming up as well. But first, we have a little bit of aviation news to start with. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Ready.
All right, our first story comes from theedgemarkets.com. Malaysia says new search for flight MH370 to end mid-June. Well, March 8th is the four-year anniversary of the disappearance of MH370, if you can believe it. That, of course, was carrying 239 people from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing in 2014. Now, the search by Australia, China, and Malaysia ended in January of 2017. They spent about $160 million U.S. in that search effort, didn't find it. This year, in January of 2018, Malaysia agreed to pay Ocean Infinity, that's a U.S. firm, up to $70 million if it found the plane within 90 search days. So they've had a vessel out there called the Seabed Constructor searching. They started searching on January 23rd. The search is still underway, but nothing yet. Now, I understand this is a no-find, no-fee type of deal. So Ocean Infinity is certainly motivated to try to find MH370. But, boy, you know, 4 years and still not much other than a few pieces that have been identified as coming from that aircraft. I don't know, Max T, do you think we'll ever find out what happened to this airplane?
You know, if I were to bet, probably not anytime soon. You know, some of these things you just don't hear about until 50 years later. This may be one of those things that we just never hear about for a really, really long time. And it's interesting that the company would take that kind of contract where, you know, no fine, no fee, especially when you figure nobody else has found this aircraft in the prior 4 years. I wonder what made them so confident that they might be able to find it. I wonder what they're doing that's different.
Yeah, it does seem like they're taking on a big risk because they're going to spend quite a bit of money looking for it. Now, my understanding is that, well, not only is the contract for 90 days, and that's not calendar days, it's search days, so days spent returning to port to refuel and reprovision and all that don't count as part of the 90 days, but coming up is the change in seasons down there in the South Indian Ocean, and my understanding is with winter approaching for them, the seas become, pretty rough and not really conducive to searching. So I guess the bottom line of that is if they don't find anything pretty soon or through June, that even if somebody were to search or to continue searching, it'd have to wait till next year. That's tough, especially for the families. I you know, you really have to feel for the families that just don't have any closure.
Yeah, it really seems like almost a mystery on the order of Amelia Earhart.
Yes, yes. Hopefully someday we'll know.
But Paul Allen found the Lexington.
He did. Yeah, tell us about that, David. That was what, the first aircraft carrier
or second aircraft carrier?
Second?
The first it was designed by off of a battle cruiser that was too big due to the naval treaty after World War I. The Lexington and the Saratoga were our first two carriers after the Langley, which was a Collier, which was a flat deck. But our first real aircraft carrier was Langley, and it sunk, and they just found it. Paul Allen of Microsoft fame found it in the Pacific, and it's got most of its aircraft on the deck, and there are early Wildcats and torpedo devastators, TBDs, and they're all in really good condition. It's kind of, I looked at it and went, I realize it's probably a memorial now and a should be a place of resting for the sailors who went there. But to see a Devastator bomber, torpedo bomber fly would be kind of awesome if they could recover the aircraft. So, or at least recover them for a couple of museums. But you know, we found Titanic, we found Lexington. Someday, the difference is those sink fairly whole. I don't know what Malaysia will look like. So,
Yeah, but David, the other thing with this is, didn't we more or less know where the Lexington was? We more or less knew where the Titanic was. With the Malaysian flight, we really have no idea, and the Pacific is an awfully big place.
And most likely it's in parts.
Yeah, making it even harder.
Well, you're right. You never know. Somebody will find something someday. Hmm.
Even if it were intact, the mass would be so much smaller than the battleship or Titanic.
Yeah, much harder to find. Yeah, the Lexington was down. There are some videos out there that you can find, some clips of the whatever they used to find this ship. The condition of the ship seems kind of remarkable. I mean, it's not just completely encrusted in, you know, sea growth and things. It's pretty easy to see the details and all. And I think it's around 3,000 meters down. There are some areas they're searching for the Malaysia 370 that are down a couple of thousand or two more meters deep. So you're talking some really deep stuff, which of course makes it even more difficult.
And if I recall correctly, this isn't the first shipwreck that Paul Allen's found. So maybe the Malaysian should be contracting with him with his success record.
Yeah, maybe. Our next item comes from the Gazette. This is, speaking of World War II, this is triple World War II ace accepts national designation for Colorado Springs Aviation Museum. Now, the Museum of World War II Aviation in Colorado Springs has been designated by Congress as a national aviation museum. And accepting the designation on behalf of the museum was retired Air Force Colonel Clarence Bud Anderson. And Bud flew a P-51 Mustang in World War II, and his plane Old Crow was flown in, I guess, as a surprise from the National Warbird Hall of Fame in Oshkosh. David, that probably had a big impression on Bud Anderson here to see his plane, his markings at this event.
It did. You do also know that Bud Anderson has been a guest on this show, right?
And he's, I guess, now 96 years old?
He is. He flew P-51s. He had a very famous wingman by the name of Chuck Yeager.
Right.
And Yeager basically has said that the better pilot was Bud Anderson. There have been multiple warbirds that have flown with the Old Crow logo. When I interviewed him for the show at Reading, his favorite version was the P-51B, but I believe the one they flew out there was his P-51D. When I met him and Yeager out at Oshkosh in 92, I guess, 91, 92, they were all the 357th, the squadron that they flew with. They were all given their own airplanes. And at the time, Yeager and Anderson, Yeager with Glamour Skalanis, Yeager and Old Crow, Free and Easy, they all went up on a Saturday morning flight, a dawn patrol. And the gentlemen were all got into their own airplanes, per se, which was kind of an awesome feat. But Bud's really cool. It is interesting that we have another National Museum for Aviation.
Yeah, the article mentions that there are 12 other national aviation museums. And I tried to create a list of those, but I'm not sure that I've got the list correct. David, what can you tell us about the national aviation museums?
Well, it all started with one, and we're kind of fond of it here on the show, which was the National Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. Eventually, the military museums followed suit, where we have the National Museum of Naval Aviation at Pensacola. We have the National Museum of the United States Air Force at Dayton. We have the Wright Memorial, which National Heritage Park, which really isn't a museum, but is more like Valley Forge or any national park. There is the National Soaring Museum, which is in Elmira or Horseheads, New York. The National World War II Museum, the National Museum of the Marine Corps. The National Aviation Hall of Fame is actually inside of the National Museum of the United States Air Force at Dayton, the National Helicopter Museum at Stratford. So there's a bunch of them, and the World War II Museum, which is not really an aviation museum per se, but it does have very famous aircraft. There's a Rex from Willow Grove that I used to grow up and look at that they restored there. But so there's a lot of museums, and our friends over at the Yankee Air Museum will eventually become a national museum for the industry when they restore the hangar for the Willow Run hangar. So all of those museums, when they get the word national, that means they get funding from the federal government, and they're not privately owned anymore. They're sort of, they're getting money from the United States.
Our next item comes from aeronews.net. F-104 flight training launches at Florida's Kennedy Space Center. Max T, this is, a new program, civilian training program for licensed pilots, comes from the Starfighters Aerospace Organization.
Got to say, I don't really fully understand, you know, what this is, but it does seem like it's a place for pilots with a lot of money to go get checked out. And F-104s, the same type of aircraft that were used to prepare astronauts for the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program. I don't think that going through that training qualifies you for a future NASA manned space mission, but it probably is one heck of a fun thing to do. And one of the gentlemen said that he said that it would be impossible to top his flight in the supersonic MiG-29, but this was even better. So it must be a heck of a lot of fun.
Boy, it sure sounds it. F-104 Starfighters, Mach 2 or higher, David, those were pretty zippy aircraft.
They were. And they were a hard aircraft to fly. They were called the missile with the man in it. The Starfighters actually were a demonstration team a couple of years ago. They would fly a three-ship, and anyone who's actually seen an F-104 fly, they're unique. They have a very, very unique sound, and it would definitely be a really fun ride to go tooling around in the backseat of one.
I understand from the article that this flight training is authorized by a LODA, a Letter of Deviation Authority, that's issued to starfighters by the FAA. This is something recent, though. I think that was issued, it says, in September of 2017. So, it sounds like a blast. I bet it's not inexpensive, but it does sound like a lot of fun.
And you are taking off and landing from the shuttle landing facility.
Which is, cool enough in and of itself.
You can actually fly the shuttle approach in an F-104, which is a very, I don't think I would want to do that, but to be able to take off and land at the shuttle, landing facility would be really kind of cool. Hmm. It's a very large runway.
Yeah, this definitely has an awful lot of cool factor to it, doesn't it?
I think it has more than just about anything I can think of. There's maybe one or two things that might be cooler than this, but yeah.
And you know, they probably have yet to have any podcasters, ride along and record what this thing is like. So I'm going to volunteer, and I'll let you guys know how it all turns out.
All right, do that.
Max, have you actually got your boom certificate? Have you gone Mach 1 yet?
I have not, no. I no matter how steeply I put the Cirrus in a dive, it will not do that.
Okay, good. Good thing.
And I'm joking, by the way, unless anybody thinks. Right. I certainly never put aircraft in dives.
Intentionally.
Yeah, or unintentionally.
Next up from AIN Online, FAA blames airlines for lack of wider ADS-B use. Well, the FAA Associate Administrator for Aviation Safety, Ali Bahrami, testified before the U.S. House of Representatives Transportation and Infrastructure's Subcommittee on Aviation. And he told the subcommittee that the ADS-B system is fully operational, but mainly it's limited because the airlines don't have the onboard equipment that they need. Max, this is pretty consistent with what we've understood to be the case, isn't it?
It is, and it's interesting that it was in response to questioning from Representative DeFazio. It was one of his comments in a hearing that occurred probably a year or two ago that I had reviewed as part of the privatization episode we did on Aviation News Talk last summer, that I first learned that there was an exemption possible for airlines to not have to fully comply with the 2020 mandate. And so this really just kind of reconfirms that. The thing I find kind of interesting is that in the past we've heard the FAA say, well, actually, they are required to comply with a mandate, but it's like, well, wait a minute. The mandate has two parts. That one part says you must be broadcasting your position using ADS-B, and you ADS-B out, to be more specific, and you must use a WAST-capable GPS so that that position being broadcast is highly accurate. And someone from the FAA said, well, they are required to comply with ADS-B. What they didn't say is they're not required to use the WASP-based GPS sensor so that that position is as accurate as is required by the mandate. So I think there's been some weasel wording going along in the past to kind of make it look like the airlines are complying when, in fact, many of them are not. And it just seems kind of ironic that the airlines just don't apparently have enough money to make this update to the GPS that everybody else is required to do in smaller GA aircraft.
There were some other organizations represented who testified at this committee meeting, including the NTSB, NASA, ALPA did, and also the DOT's Office of Inspector General. And they talked about drone regulations. They talked about pilot shortages and, as you say, privatizing air traffic control. After the hearing was concluded, that's when Bill Schuster, who's the chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, announced that the provision to privatize air traffic control would be dropped from the H.R. 2997, the reauthorization legislation. So that appears to be off the table for now.
And it will... It will, of course, rear its ugly head again. I think the proponents of privatization realize that there's not a viable path to get it through Congress right now, yeah. But I am sure that they're already hard at work figuring out some way to change the proposal or some way to implement it in the future. These people really believe it almost kind of with a religious fervor that privatization is incredibly important for a variety of reasons, and they will keep coming at this until they succeed.
Another topic is the minimum flight time requirements for airline pilots, and some folks have sought to lessen those requirements, the ones that were enacted after the Colgan air crash. ALPA had a comment on that. They said, quote, "We urge the committee to reject any proposal to modify or change that weakens the current first officer minimum qualifications." And then we also had some testimony from the NTSB on flight data recorders. They noted that they would like to see low-cost, lightweight data recorders for Part 135 operators. Also, they would like to see flight data recorders in Part 121 operations maintain 25 hours of data. Right now, the requirement is for 2 hours of data, so they'd like to see a lot more. And then they also, again, brought up the desire for cockpit cameras. They said, quote, "Some questions can only be answered through data provided by an image recorder." The FAA noted that this is a controversial topic and probably not something that was going to happen, or maybe if ever, but certainly not quickly. There need to be some careful deliberation, they say, before any kind of an FAA mandate for cockpit image recorders, film recorders.
You know, it's interesting. I was just thinking of an analogy, which is how different law enforcement agencies resisted body cams for so long, and yet finally they found a way to actually implement that at many, many agencies. I could think of all kinds of reasons why pilots might not want to have this recorded, but it seems like on balance, the data that you could gain from them would outweigh, the loss of privacy or, the other concerns they have. I think we have to look at this from a societal balance standpoint. I mean, just think of the different kinds of crashes in the past where we'd have learned something key if only there had been video.
Yes, for sure. All right. We've got an item from Forbes. This is In pushing his pilot for FAA administrator, Trump shows his disregard for safety. Now, this was, as I say, written in Forbes by past guest Christine Negroni. She writes that President Trump does his private pilot, Captain John Duncan, no service by putting him forward as a candidate to lead the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. So we talked about this last week when it was kind of breaking and we didn't have a lot of information as to what Duncan's qualifications were for this. We don't have a lot more. In fact, we don't really have anything more about that. After a week's time, we know he's worked as Trump's pilot since 1989. He flew Trump's Boeing 757 during the 2016 election campaign. That was a pretty intense travel schedule. It traveled to 203 cities and 43 states over the course of 21 months. So Duncan was certainly immersed in all of the airport and regulatory, all the, you know, the considerations necessary to maintain a travel schedule of that sort. But we really don't know a lot more. We looked a little bit about some of the other recent FAA administrators and what they came with by way of some background and experience.
Oh, and let's just go ahead and repeat the quote that came from the White House. They said, and we found no other information other than this one quote. You know, you check all the sources online, you can't really find any more detail. It said that according to the White House, an administration person said that he had, quote, managed airline and corporate flight departments, certified airlines from startup under FAA registration regulations, and oversaw the Trump presidential campaign air fleet. But there doesn't seem to be any kind of information online about, you know, what airline departments he may have managed, what corporate flight departments he have managed. So there really is kind of an absence of information about his background, other than that one statement from the White House.
Mm. And some of the recent administrators really did have a variety of experiences that qualified them for this kind of a position. Max T., why don't you take us through some of the recent administrators?
Yeah, so Marion Blakely, who was the first FAA administrator I ever met, who I talked with a couple of different times and emailed with for a while. Prior to the coming to the FAA, she was chairman of the NTSB. Previously, she was also administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And then prior to that, she had a number of different positions in government service, including in the Commerce Department, the Department of Education, National Endowment for the Humanities. So she probably is, I would say, of all of these, had probably the most experience prior to becoming the FAA administrator. Randy Babbitt, who I've also met and who I really thought the world of, I thought he was great. He was an airline pilot for Eastern for 25 years, but he then went on to serve in multiple roles in ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association. He was their executive administrator looks like about 4 years. He was president for 8 years, was also the executive administrator for ALPA as well. Michael Huerta has an interesting background. He had served in a number of different government positions, most all of them transportation related. He was commissioner for New York City Department of Ports, and he also served as the executive director for the Port of San Francisco. He then held senior positions in the United States Department of Transportation, under which, of course, the FAA is a part. This one's kind of interesting. He worked as managing director with the Salt Lake Organizing Committee for the 2002 Olympics, preparing Salt Lake's transportation outlets for the Olympics, involved in planning and construction of a variety of Olympic transportation systems. I didn't put notes in here about Bobby Sturgill. And I saw Bobby again just a couple years ago. He and I were both serving on the Collier Trophy Committee. He sat right next to me all day for that particular meeting. But my recollection, I don't have it up here in front of me, is that he's a former Navy pilot. He's also got a legal degree. And I recall he was the deputy administrator for Marion Blakey. I think he had followed her over from one of her previous jobs. So he was, you know, got a lot of experience for a few years knowing what it takes to run the FAA, because he was the number two person there, and then he later became the acting administrator, and his nomination was not confirmed, largely, some people suggest, because of some concerns about how the New York airspace was redirected and a little number of complaints about noise and things like that. And some people believe that that was the reason that his confirmation was blocked. So anyway, it is interesting to see that some of these prior administrators brought a lot of experience to the table.
And there are a few other names that are mentioned as possible candidates. The acting FAA administrator, Dan Elwell, is one of them. Also, Republican Representative Sam Graves, he sits on the Aviation Subcommittee of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. He's also a candidate. He's also a pilot.
Let's just touch base on that briefly. There was a story out yesterday in which Representative Graves said that he was unaware that he was being considered as a candidate for FAA administrator, and that he's apparently not interested in the position, which doesn't surprise me, because in talking with Jack Pelton last year when we did the privatization episode on Aviation News Talk, Jack said that it appeared from what he was hearing when he was in Washington that Sam was really very much in line to take over Representative Schuster's position as the head of the infrastructure committee within the House. And that coincidentally, about that time, Sam Graves had changed his position on privatization. Previously, he had always been opposed to ATC privatization or corporatization or whatever you want to call it. But then he suddenly supported it about the same time that there were rumors that he was in the running to take over that committee at the end of last year.
Hmm. So I guess it's worth mentioning that at this point, we don't have a specific candidate that's offered up that's to come. One question you might ask is, well, what's the process for selecting an FAA administrator? And it's actually pretty simple. If you look in Title 49 U.S. Code, paragraph 106, that deals with the Federal Aviation Administration, there's just a couple of paragraphs that apply. Paragraph A says the Federal Aviation Administration is an administration in the Department of Transportation, right? Fairly simple. And then Section B, the head of the administration is the administrator, who shall be appointed by the president by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. When making an appointment, the president shall consider the fitness of the individual to carry out efficiently the duties and powers of the office. The term shall be 5 years. The other requirements in paragraph C here, the administrator must, one, be a citizen of the United States, two, be a civilian, which is interesting, and three, have experience in a field directly related to aviation. And then it goes on from there, talks about the deputy administrator, who is also appointed by the president. But there's a few caveats here about or relating to military duty, active duty, and things like that. It's not as restrictive as for the administrator. So it's pretty simple. The president nominates one. Congress has to approve, and that's it for 5 years. So we'll see what happens next. Again, we're speaking with Charlene Fontaine, founder and executive director of the Flying Tigers 69th DRS Association. Charlene, welcome again to the show. What can you tell us about what the Flying Tigers 69th DRS Association is all about, what the mission is, and what you're trying to accomplish?
Thank you, Max, for having me this evening to discuss and share with you all and your listeners about our organization. We started in 2005. We are a nonprofit, and we are the ones who are carrying the legacy and the history of our squadron, as well as all Flying Tigers, the AVG Flying Tigers, the 14th Air Force Flying Tigers, and the current Tigers. Our mission is to literally carry their legacy and their history forward, which unfortunately has been left out predominantly of the history books. If you look at a history book now on a high school level in our country, World War II only has maybe, if we're lucky, 4 pages. And the challenge then becomes, well, how do we tell the story of World War II? And most people know more about the history of World War II from the European perspective and the South Pacific, but most people don't even realize we were in China, Burma, and India.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I remember when I was a kid, you know, learning my history back in the, God, I hate to say this, in the 60s and 70s, it hadn't been all that many years since World War II. And, you know, that was still fresh in a lot of people's minds. But it's been so long now that it's interesting how it sort of starts to fade away from what we pass on to the, you know, the next generation. So how do we make them aware of the history, keep them from being in a situation where they just haven't been exposed to it? How do we do that?
Well, we go and we help the education process in our country. We can do that a number of ways. There's National History Day, which involves students in our country from middle school all the way through high school. And if they're interested about learning about National History Day, they can go to our website and find a link there, or go to National History Day on Google and find them. It's a great way for students to become involved, parents to become involved, as well as community leaders who want more students to know. It's like with the Warbirds associations across our country, they're carrying the history of aviation as well as the different planes who fought in various wars. So we have those avenues to go. And then the avenues that we're looking at is how do we get them engaged in something that's going to allow them to take what our dads and granddads learned, and uncles and great uncles, what they learned, and how they can apply it to their lives today. So we can also involve that through video games as well, because we have to speak to them in a language that they are used to and not our language of you pick up the phone on the corner desk and you talk from there versus everything they have, their computer and all is in their cell phone in their hands.
Right.
So we have a tremendous gap to bridge, if you will.
Well, how about a brief history of the Flying Tigers and what happened? I mean, it's there obviously have been books and books and books written about this, and in movies and all kinds of things. And we'll talk about some of that coming up too. But is there a way to kind of encapsulate the story here?
Sure. Actually, in 1937, Claire Chennault was asked to go to China by Madame Chiang Kai-shek and her husband, General Chiang Kai-shek, who was the leader of the Chinese KMT Party. And because the Chinese Air Force had actually been decimated due to the Japanese coming after them starting in 1931 in Manchuria. And they had fought almost 10 years of war. So Chennault went over and decided to help them out as best as he could. And so he asked that we have a group called the American Volunteers Group is what it was. They were put together by a group, the Camargo Group. They were recruited in a very clandestine way. And when they left the U.S., there were 100 pilots and almost 300 ground crew folks. And they went off and they went to China and they helped the Chinese, and they reported to the Chinese Air Force. They had a year's contract. They were paid, the pilots were paid $600, and the ground crew were paid $350. They fought in Burma. They were actually stationed in Burma, and their first engagement was in the day after Pearl Harbor in 1941. So that was their first engagement. Then they wound their way up into China and were stationed in Kunming and in various other bases all over China.
And so in a way, they were kind of behind the lines, behind the enemy lines, as it were, of the Japanese. Is that a correct way to look at it? China is obviously such a large landmass.
Yes, it is. And yes, they were behind enemy lines, both in China and Burma and India. And one of the most dangerous things that the Tigers had to do was fly the route of the hump, which is the Himalayan mountains, which you all know as being pilots. The toughest part of that is the weather that goes on there. So they had a really tough go of it. And then after their contract was over, July 4th, 1942, there was a dilemma. And the President Roosevelt asked that the 14th Air Force be formed. And it was, it had a bunch of iterations to it from the Army Air Corps, because when you ask the guys, they all said, well, we were in the Army. And I go, well, no, you weren't. You were in the Army Air Corps. No, we were in the Army. So there was a little dissent of who they were and such. But General Chouinard went on and they formed the 14th Air Force. Finally, that's what its name was and still is. And their records were absolutely outstanding, both for the AVG, what they accomplished in a year, and for the 14th Air Force and what they accomplished.
So when you say AVG, Charlene, what are you referring to?
That refers to the American Volunteer Group, which is kind of a misnomer. They were a clandestine group, and they were not volunteers. They had a contract for a year, and most of the pilots and the ground crew were men who were either in the Navy, the Marines, and they had special permission to forego their commissions. And after their contract was over, the deal was they were supposed to have been taken back into their groups, whatever, Marines or Navy, and go about their jobs as lieutenants, colonels, whatever. And that just didn't happen with some of them. Some of them stayed with Chouinard in the 14th to form the 14th and various squadrons. And then some of them went on back, like Pappy Boyington went back to the Navy, the Corps. My Corps friends would not be happy with me right now. there's so many guys to keep straight. But they all went about their way, and some of them actually got out of it and went to England to fight, which was very interesting to me. They, after fighting in China and Burma, they went to the opposite side of the world and fought there and in Africa as well.
Yeah, but Charlene, they were volunteers from the sense that they were not drafted into that position. They voluntarily went to serve, even though they were paid for their work, right?
That's correct, Brian. Yes. They were not drafted. It was just a volunteer group. What happened is they actually, Camargo ran ads in newspapers and went around the country recruiting at different bases and asking them who is adventurous enough, I guess is the right way to say that the gentleman have told me, who was adventurous enough, who wanted to go off to this part of the world that not many people knew much about and wanted to lay their life on the line. And several of them that were, I talked to one that's still with us, the other ones have been deceased, but they were all saying it was for the adventure and the money, because the ground crew alone was going to make $350 a month, and that was four times the amount that the military was paying. So if you take the adventure and a ticket to go to a part of the world that you knew nothing about, you take the money, and then you take to see what you're going to experience for a year, well, if you're 19, 20, 21 years old, wouldn't you want to take it?
I can understand that completely. Yeah, that very much sounds like a young man's kind of game. Should I assume that these were all men? Were there women that were part of this as well?
Well, there were women, but the women were naturally in those days. Remember, gentlemen, we're talking about the 40s.
Yeah, exactly.
They were relegated to being secretaries and nurses, and then the women came in with Jacqueline Cochran and the Wasps, and they were, we had some very successful women who were pilots. And the one thing that you talked about earlier with the FAA situation about the limited number of pilots we currently have brings me back to the fact that in World War II, most realize that enlisted men were allowed to be pilots because we had such a shortage of pilots. And so the women that were pilots in our country and all around the world, actually, but for the U.S., is what they would do is they would go to the different places and the different factories in the country that manufactured all of our wonderful aircraft that we flew, from the P-40 all the way through to the C-47s and the bombers. And as what would happen is they would ferry the planes then over to the different parts in the world, both in Europe and in China. And then they would come back and they would take some more planes over whenever they were done. So the women were active, but we were actually what you would call behind the lines.
Yes. Well, you mentioned that this represented kind of a hardship given where they were traveling, all of these folks. Any stories about some of the challenges that they encountered?
The stories are very fascinating, so I'll do one short one about how they actually got to China. The pilots were taken, interestingly enough, some of them on ships, some of them not. The AVG were actually taken from on a cruise liner, a Dutch cruise liner. So they got to be pretty well treated when they went. However, different story for the 14th Air Force. Most of those pilots would fly down to Brazil and then across and go through Africa, and then up in India. The ground crews, however, were a totally different ballgame. The 69th, which was a fourth echelon squadron, which is my first love, why I'm in this wonderful situation to start with. My dad was a 69er, and they were part of the 301st Air Depot Group. And it's what they did is they started in Kelly Field, and they went from Kelly Field, and before they left, they were only told to load everything in semi-tractor trailer trucks, the trailers themselves, and everything they would need to do, anything it would take to repair or rebuild an aircraft. They weren't told where they were going. They left Kelly Field in January with their woolies on. And then once they were out to sea from Long Beach, California, they left on the Admiral Benson. And once they were out to sea, they were told they were going somewhere, but they didn't know where again. Then when they finally arrived in Australia and it was hot, they were told they were going to the Indian Ocean. And then they ended up in India. And then they took their tractor trailer and put them on railroad cars. And then they traversed the Burma Road and through the Himalayan Mountains. And they ended up in Kunming, China.
That's quite a trip for someone who doesn't know where they're headed.
Exactly. And so it was interesting. Dad said that the guys complained a lot when they were in India because it was very, very hot, and in Burma as well. But then when they got to China, it was a little bit cooler. So they had to have a number of different types of uniforms that were not readily in supply, shall we say. So as usual, they used a lot of Yankee ingenuity.
There's something about shark's teeth. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. The shark's teeth story is amazing. The first time that shark's teeth were actually seen was in 1940. And they were seen actually on a Luftwaffe plane that was against the RAF 112 fighter squadron. And the Brits saw these shark's teeth coming at them, and they really kind of liked it. And so then they implemented them in their time in Africa in 41, and it was well publicized at home under the London News. And the AVG, there was several people in the AVG who read this magazine and saw it and said, well, we really like that. They took the idea to Chenault, and Chenault gave them permission to paint the shark's teeth however they could on the P-40s, that the 99 of the P-40s that were in China. And so it went from Germany to the Brits to the good old USA.
David, I've seen the teeth on A-10s, of course, these P-40s. Have they appeared on any other notable aircraft that you can think of?
Do I really have to go through this list?
Sure, David, come on.
Starting in World War One, Spads. Starting almost every aircraft ever, at one point or another, has had shark's teeth.
Oh, really?
So P-51s, P-38s, P-47s, F-4 Phantoms, F-15s, F-16s, now C-130s. Now the C-130s, the H-60Gs, H-60G Pavehawks, and A-10s all trace their lineage back to the Flying Tigers. They're part of the 14th Air Force. But just about every major aircraft ever has had shark's teeth, including some civilian aircraft. So the Tomahawks in North Africa were P-40Bs like the AVG flu. So the Brits in North Africa were the first ones to have the shark's teeth, and then they were copied. And then it became standardized. But the A10s that you've seen with shark's teeth,
yes,
they are the lineage back to the American Volunteer Group. That's why they carry them.
So, well, David, why do you think the P-40s become so popular? I think whenever anyone thinks of an aircraft with shark's teeth, they go back to the P-40 as being the originator of it.
Three letters, A-V-G. The American Volunteer Group and the Flying Tigers were the ones that made shark's teeth famous, but I can't think of an airplane that I haven't seen shark's teeth on at one point or another. They just inevitably show up eventually. And I'm sure that eventually an F-35 and an F-22 will get them also. They just do. But it's primarily because of the Flying Tigers fame. We'd also like to thank John Wayne for that. because he also made that very famous with the Flying Tigers movie. So that's why. But I have books that on shark's teeth. There's a marketing book from Osprey that was literally it's shark's teeth. It's every aircraft and what they've worn. So, and they were from originally, way back in the day in World War I, they've had shark's teeth. So it's just airplanes get shark's teeth.
Right. And the other thing right now, Max and David, y'all, so you have an understanding, which I did not know this. They tried to paint them on a current squadron of Flying Tigers, except they're Flying Tigers Air Force helicopter pilots. And these gentlemen fly all over the world doing rescue missions. Some of them fly out of Nullis. There's a number of them of the squadron that do. And but they have an FT on their back wing.
The tail code for, if you notice the A-10s with shark's teeth, likewise the HH-60Gs that have the shark's teeth, as well, not the 130s when Pope was, when they made the combined unit, but they all have FT on as their tail code. Like most states have, like ED is Edwards and their base, or LA would be Louisiana. But the tail codes for the A-10s, if you note, is FT, which is Flying Tigers, on both the helicopters and the aircraft and the A-10s.
Charlene, do I understand that you're working on a movie associated with this topic?
Yes, we are, Max. We took on this project as a documentary about 5 years ago to tell the story of the 69th and their journey and what they did as a fourth echelon squadron. And that was to, they were the only factory in China that was able to retool, rebuild, and recreate aircraft after they were downed. So we thought their story was pretty interesting. And then they told me, well, you can't tell our story without telling all the Flying Tiger story. So then we added another 25,000 people instead of 350. And then they told me, no, you can't tell our story without telling all of CBI because it's the forgotten war. And I went, oh, let's just do 250,000. I don't have anything better to do, guys. Yeah, so that's how it got started. It's now up to 7 segments. We're talking about the Flying Tigers and overview history of the China Broom, India, Flying Tigers, AVG, and 14th and their legacies. And then the 69th, they are we call the 8 balls against all odds squadron. Then the peoples in power, the different generals, and the presidents, the leaders of the world, and then some people that we didn't know very much about that really were pulling the strings behind the scenes, one of them being Madame Chiang Kai-shek herself and a few other ladies. And then the home front, POWs, and how women fought in the war and what they did to help. So it's going to be a really interesting documentary that people are calling me Ken Burnsette.
Oh, yeah, this is quite a large sounding project. How far along are you?
Well, we're in different various stages. We're still interviewing because every time almost every week I get a phone call or an email or a letter from someone saying, well, my uncle, my father, somebody in their family was a Flying Tiger and both AVG and 14th, or somebody in CBI like Merrill's Marauders or the Chindits or something. And they say, here, we have this information for you. And if they're still alive, I will go interview the individual. If they're not, is what I will do is get all the information I can from the family and then interview them. And so it's going to be, it's an interesting project. And I hope your listeners are interested and excited about it, because it's going to tell a story that some historians that I've talked to across the country at different facilities, research facilities, have said has been an undertold story, and we definitely need to know it.
Is there kind of no central place where the documentation and, you know, the artifacts and all the things that create and document the history, is there no kind of single place for all this? Is it pretty thinly scattered about?
Thinly scattered about, Max, all over the country, if not the world.
Yeah, I kind of gathered that.
I've been to Maxwell. I've been to National Archives a number of times, Maxwell a number of times. I need to go to Pennsylvania. I need to speak to them. And I did not realize this, so everyone please excuse my ignorance. I was so focused on the Flying Tigers. I had no idea that every branch of service, the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Coast Guard, Army, the whole enchilada of our military were serving in China before World War II and during World War II and after World War II.
This is a fascinating story. I imagine also that the you know, the depot, the group of people who are responsible for doing the maintenance and repairs and all of the aircraft, that must have been a really, really difficult job, especially being so far away and out where the sort of the supply chain maybe was not as robust as you'd like to see.
You're correct, Max. And on our website, there's some pictures of our guys driving the Burma Road with the tractor trailer trucks. And if you think of it, and the 6x6s, the road was barely, in some places, 15 feet wide. And we're not talking about a concrete road. We're talking about a dirt road that was recreated because it was actually the old spice route that Marco Polo took. And in Burma, it was literally a jungle that our Army Corps of Engineers had to chop their way through. So it was just a very intense place to have to go from our country to there to help save that part of the world.
And I'm sure there's a lifetime of stories and experiences to relate from the people who participated in this. And there must not be too many of those folks left anymore.
Now, actually, Nell Chenault Calloway, General Chenault's granddaughter, and I work on several projects. She through her the Chenault Museum in Monroe, Louisiana, and then myself with the 69th in our project for the history story and our scholarship programs. And we found now out of the 25,000 men and women who served General Chenault during World War II, we have found that there is only now we are down to 20 men left.
My goodness, wow.
That we can find. And if so, some of your listeners out there know other men or women that served under Chenault or in CBI, if they would kindly let us know, we would be exceedingly grateful because we want to connect and honor them properly.
Sure, of course. Well, Charlene, fascinating. We were able to touch on just a little bit of this. Where can our listeners learn more about the Flying Tigers 69th DRS Association?
If they go to flyingtigers69thdrs.com, they'll find our website. They'll find our trailer for the Forgotten War, China, Burma, India. They'll find a number of ways to learn about the organization as well as the Flying Tigers and China, Burma, India veterans. And there's also a way to donate if they're so kind to help be supportive of either our scholarship fund or our history project with this documentary.
Tell us a little bit about the scholarship fund.
Since 1986, we have given 22 scholarships away. We have two funds. One of them is the Marty Oxenberg Scholarship Fund that we started to honor the founder of the 69th DRS Association. And the other one is the scholarship that's been endowed by Hank Tursky to honor his wife, who was Chinese. He married her as an enlisted personnel, which he was in Shanghai, shipped her home. And they had a beautiful marriage for over 55 years, and she passed recently, and he passed recently. And it's the Doris Van Tursky Scholarship Fund. And anyone who is eligible who has military contacts with the Flying Tigers, or excuse me, legacy, or current military personnel. And then after those, if we have money left, each year we give other awards to people who are so inclined. And need the aid to go to school and does research, most importantly, all on the Flying Tigers to carry the legacy forward.
God, that's wonderful.
Thank you.
The aviation scholarships, there are a number of them, but I think they're not always, well, people don't always take full advantage of them. I think that this is another great one to consider. I'm really happy that you've been able to talk to our audience about, the scholarship, but also all the activities that you're doing and the Flying Tigers and the movie coming up. Any idea when that might be released?
We are shooting for the end of this year. Two of my producers just look at me and laugh and go, really? And I go, yes. I may have to sequester myself in a dark room and just edit and write from there. But that's the goal. And people can, if they go to the website, Max, they can sign up for our newsletter. And there will be blog postings as well as the newsletters going about to update people as to where we are and where we will be having premieres. And I am available, as well as other people in our speakers bureau, to come talk around the country about the Flying Tigers.
Ah, fantastic. Charlene Fontaine, thank you so much for being on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you, gentlemen, and much success to you all. And thanks for what you do.
Thank you. Just wanted to give a brief mention to the AIN Human Factor podcast. This is produced by our friend Pete Combs, and we'll have a link in the show notes to the most recent episode as we record this, episode 11, Takeoff and Landing Assessments, and they take a look at how aviation organizations as well as individuals in the industry have worked together to improve takeoff and landing assessments for pilots. This is a really, really great podcast. If you haven't listened to it or run across it yet, we really encourage you to do that. You can find it at AINonline.com/human factor.
Besides, it's really cool listening to Pete's voice.
Pete has a great voice for doing this kind of work, and he's a great guy. Pete is just fantastic. We want to thank him also for mentioning Airplane Geeks podcast on the Human Factor. All right, we have a positive commercial airplane story of the week. Let's see, does this come from you, Brian?
It does, and this is one that hopefully David won't be too upset about because it does involve United Airlines, but it's a positive story, so. A woman apparently lost her wedding ring on a United flight between New York and Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And the fine folks at United ended up finding the ring, and a captain of United ended up hand delivering it back to her. So I thought it was really nice, instead of just putting it in the mail and shipping it off to her, that it had that personal bit of touch and follow through on the part of the United captain. So hats off to United for doing the right thing.
Yeah, a great story. And with a great outcome. I mean, you lose your wedding ring, you know, what are the odds of ever being able to find that or recover that? So really glad it worked out so well. And yeah, you're right. This pilot really, really handled this really nicely. Well, the whole organization, the folks that found it and kept it safe and everybody along that process. So good work.
Yeah, and I think that the quote that he's attributed with, he goes, "So happy I was able to return this ring to you. From day to day, I take pride in getting passengers from point A to point B safely and on time. Today, I'm happy to be part of the team focused on making just one individual happy." And that being her, of course, getting her ring back.
Yes, great.
So definitely a team effort.
All right, as far as what's up with the geeks, David, you'd mentioned that you'll be attending the FAA AUVSI symposium on UAV regulations. And we might have a couple of our listeners who are also going to be there. Maybe you'll be able to get together with those guys.
Yep. You can always ping me at david@theuavdigest.com. I'll have it. So if you're going to be at the show and you see me, say hi. I love meeting our listeners on those kind of events. So when this comes out on Wednesday, there'll be a chance that you will catch up to me to those diehard listeners. And if I get snowed in, maybe I will be there Thursday.
Right. And Brian, you attended a presentation recently, I think.
Yeah, going back to the Planes of Fame, I'm taking advantage of my annual membership at the through that organization, Planes of Fame, out in Chino, and their monthly presentation was on the Corsair, which is also in my top five most favorite aircraft. So it was really interesting hanging out with, I don't know, 100, 150 or so aviation enthusiasts, and they through Skype had a pilot of the Corsair, and he was, I think, 97 years old. It was kind of hard to hear him because it was through Skype and his age, but he talked about flying the aircraft in the Pacific and gave it very high marks. So it was just fun learning more information about the Corsair.
Cool. All right. Launchpad Marzari has sent us.
Hold on. Let's challenge Brian.
Let's challenge Brian.
Oh, well, no, I don't remember anything. I just attend these events.
What flying tiger went on to become very famous flying the Corsair?
Besides Pappy Boyington?
Well, Pappy. Yeah.
Yeah.
He got it.
Okay, I got that one. Whew. I get to keep my wings one more week.
That's right. Okay, we have some recordings. The first one is from Launchpad Marzari, and this is just kind of a quick, fun thing he put together, and we'll have some more coming up from him in the near future. But for now, let's just listen to this little fun piece from Launchpad.
I recently had to speak with a dispatcher who unfortunately did not know her phonetic alphabet, which led her to spell everything by example substitution. B as in boy, A as in apple, D as in dog. Yeah, this is bad. You get the idea. This drives me up the wall. As the phonetic alphabet is used in computer science, aviation, law enforcement, the military, and many other professions in the Western Hemisphere, I don't think it's too much to ask for people in these industries to know this. So, to encourage people to learn their phonetic alphabets, I began using an improved letter substitution whenever I encounter someone like this. Allow me to give you some quick sample. T as in tsunami. P as in pterodactyl. W as in Y. Y as in you. K as in no. N as in no. G as in Gnostic. M as in mnemonic. S as in C. C as in czar. X as in xenon, O as in on, H as in honest, A as in aisle, and E as in excess. I'm sure you guys can come up with other examples, but you get the idea. So please, everyone, learn your phonetic alphabet. This is your Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Oh, that's pretty funny. I don't know the phonetic alphabet. I'm embarrassed to say. Probably all you guys do. Max, you do definitely.
I do. Yeah, I liked Launchpad's closing there. Yeah. Their reference to the frequency, and then Paul Harvey's good day. Now, I don't remember Paul Harvey saying anything about the frequency, but he definitely said good day at the every broadcast.
Yes, he did. David, you've got to know the phonetic alphabet.
No. Which one? The original one or the new one?
I don't know. Is there a difference?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask about, because there seems to be at least two.
Oh. Exactly. Yeah, and I think, I don't remember this for sure.
Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot, Gulf, Hotel.
That's the international one that's used most commonly. The other one, which was not used commonly at all, I think was considered the American one, but I can't remember for sure if that's the case.
V is in victory, A-N, D is in David, E-R, H is in horse, O-O, F is in Frank. That's how I spell my name.
Oh, I got it. Okay, good, good. All right, well, thanks, Launchpad, for sending that in. We've also got queued up next time, I think, interview that he did with pilot partner Ken Viard, who has been on the show before. But we'll have that coming up shortly. But next, we have a recording from listener Ron. Ron took a gyroplane ride for his birthday, and he's got a little report about his adventure.
Hello, geeks. Ron here with a short adventure report. For my birthday last week, I took an intro flight in a gyroplane or a gyrocopter. A bit about me real quick. I'm a single-engine and multi-engine commercial pilot and have a private helicopter license as well, which provided me a little bit of perspective on the gyrocraft that are somewhere in the middle between an airplane and a helicopter. So I took a ride in a Trendak Tercel, a side-by-side two-seat gyroplane powered by a turbocharged Rotax with 135 horsepower. It's certified under the experimental amateur-built rules, and the flight school had an authorization from the FAA to conduct flight training in the experimental amateur-built aircraft. It's slightly different than other gyro designs, from what I was told, as it has a twin tail boom design, which offers greater rudder authority, especially at slower airspeeds, and it also has a slightly larger distance between the two main wheels, providing a little bit more stability on the ground. The cockpit was roomy width-wise, and it had a center console actually for storing it, a little storage area, and I had an armrest. Height-wise, it was just right for my 6-foot frame, but if I was much taller, I might need a shorter seat installed. Visibility was the most amazing thing. The doors were basically big giant windows, and with no engine out front, visibility at the front was excellent as well. For the flight, after pre-flight, we started up the engine and taxied out to do run-up, and then pre-rotate the main rotor. A lever inside the cockpit engaged a mechanical linkage between the Rotax engine and the main rotor in order to get it up to adequate RPMs for takeoff. The pusher prop provided us our thrust, and then the air flowing through the main rotor, the rotating main rotor gave us lift, and we were off. Took off and was about 500 feet or so at our density altitude of around 4,500 feet, and we turned out of the pattern to go do some maneuvers. My instructor explained a lot of the aerodynamics and handling characteristics as we flew over some farmland. When flying airplanes, generally altitude is your friend, giving you some time and distance in case of emergency. With the gyroplane, I actually felt real safe at 1,000-foot altitude, and with our 50-foot landing distance, we had lots of options available. My instructor explained many of the emergency procedures in case the engine out or we had experienced higher rates of descent, and then after that, he let me have the controls. It was just absolutely amazing. I could count the cows in the pasture as we turned the gyroplane around in a tight 360 at about 20 to 30 degrees of bank, and I definitely enjoyed our 70-knot airspeed. It was low and slow at its finest. If it wasn't 40 degrees outside, I probably would have enjoyed having the doors off as well. We headed back to the airport and did a regular landing and then a simulated engine out landing. Both landings felt very similar to helicopter auto-rotation with a steeper glide path than an aircraft, and we approached at about 65 to 70 knots indicated. We flared at the bottom similar to an airplane and landed less than 50 feet. It was quite the birthday present and an enjoyable experience. So for your next birthday, I highly recommend filling your day with an aviation experience, whether it be a gyro intro flight, a helicopter ride, or an airplane ride with a friend to a new place. Go and fill your logbook. Have a great day, geeks. Bye. Ron.
Well, thanks for that, Ron. Have any of you guys flown one of these things, a gyroplane, gyrocopter, anything like that?
No, I'd like to, though.
No, I have not either.
That's McParent's joy in life.
When I see these things, I'm really intrigued by them, and I think I really want to try this, but it might scare the heck out of me. I'm not sure, but it just looks like it's real flying. You know, you're really kind of out there, up there, exposed, and it just seems like what a great way to spend the afternoon.
Yeah, I kind of put it in the same bucket as being in a glider.
Yes.
I know they're very, very different, but to me, they're just sort of the same sort of crazy flying stuff.
Yeah, great stuff. All right, on to a little bit of listener mail. First one, actually, this was a comment on episode 492, last episode on our website. And this comes from James, and he's talking about our comments last week about the Trump administration's proposal or apparent proposal for a FAA administrator. And Jim writes, surprisingly uninformed and politically unbalanced conversation about Trump administration's proposal of personal pilot for FAA job. I say surprisingly because you guys usually come to the table with a fairly complete set of information to share with the audience. He writes, Max, I realize you were about the only voice of balance and reason at the table, but I've got to vote with my wallet and cancel my monthly Patreon support.
Which Max, by the way?
Well,
just wondering.
Yeah, I don't know. A couple of things. First is, as we said many times, anytime we get into politics, we get into trouble with at least a couple of listeners. So it's not unexpected. The topic of who's going to be the next FAA administrator is certainly something that we want to cover and talk about and comment on. We don't like to get too deep into the politics of it, but it's kind of hard not to in these days. Some would say fortunately, some would say unfortunately, I guess. But we, you know, we try to be objective about it. We obviously we have to rely on the facts that we can glean. It's difficult to verify some of this kind of stuff, vet some of this kind of stuff. So hopefully it's reasonably balanced, but it's kind of impossible to be totally balanced and objective when you have conversations on this topic.
And let's face it, for once, the usually quiet political guy was the one who put the story in, me.
Yeah, I know. That was the biggest shocker of the whole thing last week, David.
Hate mail can go to Rob Mark at Flying Magazine.
And I'm sure this won't be the last we hear of this story as well, so...
Yeah, for sure. This story is really just getting started, I think.
Yeah. I don't know. I also think that it's our goal to get the most competent, most qualified person in that position. Yes?
Yes.
I really don't care who it is. I just want them to do a fantastic job.
Here we go. No. Well, the game is – part of the problem is – The game has changed. I mean, in the past administrations have, I think, done just exactly what you said, Brian, is tried to, try to find a highly qualified individual to lead the organization, the agency or whatever. There's kind of a new strategy happening in Washington now that says, well, maybe you don't necessarily need an expert in that field at the top of the organization. Maybe you needed a person with a little bit different qualities than we've seen in the past, and let the organization provide the expertise, underneath it. Now, jury's still out as to whether that works or not, but I think that's partly what we're seeing happening here.
Can I just comment on Max Trescott's list that in all of those people he talked about, not a single one of them was a pilot?
Well, let's see. Randy Babbitt was a pilot.
Randy was, yeah, you're right. But and the other one,
Marion Blakey, was actually taking flying lessons, so that was not well known. She tried to keep that fairly quiet. I just happen to know her flight instructor.
Well, okay, shoot my theory, Max. I just
and Michael Huerta wasn't a pilot.
No, he was not.
So he's not a pilot. Okay,
no.
No, but the deputy administrator, Mike Whitaker, was.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, ultimately, at the top end of the pyramid, you want to have a variety of different skill sets, not the least of which are being organizational skill sets, running complex organizations, surviving in the politics of Washington, as well as technical knowledge, and I mean, all that kind of stuff. And maybe it's too much to expect one person to have all those qualities, but at least in the top couple of people, you want to make sure that all those things are covered, I would hope. But
Max Trescott for FAA admin.
Yeah, there we go.
Actually, I think that I'm probably not qualified. And I say that because you really want someone who's administered, run a very large organization and has managed large budgets. And, you know, I've managed small groups and small budgets, but nothing of that size.
I was going to say that podcast of yours has got a budget of billions of zeros.
Oh, sure.
And
well, there's a reason the job title ends in administrator. I'll just leave it at that. We also heard from Utah Patrick, and he writes and says, this looks like something that could be of interest to your listeners in the D.C. area. This is called We Can Do It, Women in Aviation and Space, and it's a one-day event at the National Air and Space Museum at the Uvarhazy Center in Northern Virginia, coming up March 10th, runs from 10 to 3 p.m., and according to the description of the event, it says women will have an immense impact on the future of space, aviation, and other STEM fields. Join us as we celebrate Women's History Month with a day of hands-on activities for families, Rosie the Riveter photo opportunities, and special guests who will inspire the next generation of women to break down barriers. It says the family day will look back at groundbreaking women of the past and forward to what can and will be achieved by women in the future. So sounds like a really great event. We added that to the aviation calendar at avgeekfests.com. And again, we've asked you to help with that in the past, and we'll do so again in the future. And a number of events have been loaded in for 2018. So if you are aware of some great aviation events, places where Av Geeks would meet and congregate, please visit avgeekfests.com and add those into the calendar. And if you're looking for something to do, you can jump into that and see if there's an event going on in your area, something that you can attend yourself. So we hope you'll all help contribute, make this a successful resource for everybody. All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank Charlene Fontaine for joining us. She's the founder and executive director of the Flying Tigers 69th DRS Association. Charlene, again, thanks so much for joining us.
You are so welcome, Max. Thanks to all of you, and we so appreciate the work you all are doing.
And if you want to learn more about the association, of course, visit FlyingTigers69thDRS.com. As always, find us on the web at AirplaneGeeks.com. We have a number of resources there, including the show notes for this and every episode. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/493. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, let's start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on the UAV Digest Twitter feed over the next couple of days. And you can always find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones on the UAVDigest.com. And a shout out, we'd love for you to join our Slack listener team. So send an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com so you can join the fun and all of the discussions on our Slack listener team.
Great. And Brian Coleman, how do we get in touch with you?
Oh, the best place to get a hold of me is either out at the Chino Airport one day a month or by email at brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And Max Trescott, how about you?
Oh, the usual place. Go to aviationnewstalk.com or look for Aviation News Talk wherever you find podcasts.
And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby on the PaxX podcast at PaxXPodcast.com. We've got another episode coming out any moment now, so you can look for that there. Our outro music is by Bruno Massone. He puts together these really interesting compositions. He takes some music and he takes some recordings of aviation sounds and he puts them all together, blends them together, and creates some fantastic stuff. So look for him at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
Bye, everyone.
everybody.
And thanks for listening.
Can I ask you one question?
Yeah, sure.
Yesterday, I was in our library, and I found this old book called Lawson, L-A-W-S-O-N, Aircraft Industry Builder.
Huh.
Have you either Max or Max heard of this?
Or David?
No.
Or David?
I think, yeah, David's gone.
Okay.
Lawson, L-A-W-S-O-N?
Yes, Aircraft Industry Builder, and I quick zipped through it like I do all old books just to see if it was something I was very interested in. And it's about this gentleman, his last name is Lawson, who was in the aircraft industry in the 1900s in our country and around the world. And he holds patents in Germany, US, and a couple, Italy, France.
Oh, Alfred Lawson.
Must be. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, this was, I don't know a lot about this guy. He was a baseball player, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I guess, let's see.
Alfred W. Lawson, yes.
Yeah, he founded the Lawson Aircraft Company in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Oh, my gosh.
Military training aircraft.
Wow, I was blown away by the content of the book and the pictures and the copy of the different letters and patents and just everything imaginable. I was like, whoa. And the 1900s, this man did all of this? And before? 19?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I'm looking this up. The Lawson L4, a big biplane, a really large yes. biplane. Three engine, I think?
Yes. I'm looking at this and I looked at this and I went, oh, this looks like some of the modern day airplanes.
It does, yeah. Yeah. I see something here. It says he's sort of credited with inventing the idea of an airliner.
Yes.
Jeez, what wasn't he into?
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, this man was just like unbelievable. So it's like, okay, I have to ask at least the guys, you know, are you familiar with this gentleman until I can jump into this further? Because I bought it for a number of reasons, but I was like, this man was amazing.
Yeah, I'm looking at this. He says he completed a 2,000-mile flight.
Oh. Yes, I saw he has the he has the maps and such and comments in here of where he went and what the route was supposed to be and everything else. It's just mind-boggling to me. And I'm such a dates do not stay in my mind.
Yeah,
but look at pictures and I'm like, whoa, this man had it wired.
Huh?
And in such an early age when. I mean, and not to have the, how do you call that? The acknowledgement, if you will, and reputation of other people in our country that did, I would say, somewhat less than he did in the industry. And
yeah.
I'm the novice at the history of it, but I was just blown away. It'd be great. I'm sorry, I'm taking over your program. It would be great to see if there is somebody who really, you know, can pop this stuff open and have a little bit of talk about history.
Yeah, this looks maybe we should get David on this.
About.
Yeah, this is this looks like there's a lot of fascinating stuff here.
And yes. being a baseball player for 19 years as well. Sheesh.
Yes. See, that's the part that I think is so phenomenal about people in this industry, because you asked me, Max, what degree did I have to do all of this? Well, I how do you call that? I went to one and I did my best and I was successful and I said, I'm bored. I'm going to go do something else.
Yeah.
So I, you know, things I love to do, I went and did. Like I raced cars for a while. Why I never got my flight license.
What kind of auto racing did you do?
SCCA.
Oh, yeah. What did you race?
And I had in Indianapolis, Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky.
Really?
And I had an MGB. Yeah. And I only raced for a year and a half until someone decided to pull out in front of me in a Mercedes, four-door Mercedes and I ended up being extricated from my MGB.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, I was so sad because my family didn't know I raced.
But they found out after that, I bet.
No, not really. They found out, honestly, Max, they found out my dad's best friend in Cincinnati was the Murgard boys, and their family owned bowling alleys. And Mr. Murgard, I knew from growing up there, he was in Indianapolis where we lived, and I was always there for the time trials and the races of the 500. And Donnie came up to me in Gasoline Alley in front of my dad and said, "Hey, my nickname's Carly. Hey, Carly, I understand you have your racing license." And I looked at him and rolled my eyes and I went, "Oh, no." And my father walked over and said, "Excuse me?" And Donnie says, "I want your daughter to race for me." And my dad goes, "No way. Not my daughter."
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So it's up. Yeah, exactly. But I love stuff. So I said, "Oh, I like that. I think I'll go do that." And I like that. And I'll go do that. So, and I was blessed to meet all the right people. And I worked at my consulting practice for the military. I did not tell anyone my father was a flying tiger. I did it all on my own.
I can understand that. Yeah, sure.
And now that they know me and know what I've been doing since 2005 for their organization, they're all like, "Wow, we didn't know." I said, "There's a reason why you didn't know. I didn't want you to know." Now I honor them. It's not about me and my business. It's about honoring them.
Yes. And that's the right kind of motivation, right? That's the genuine, you know, the genuineness of it, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I told Brian, we have a, since we're not on recording right now, we have a gentleman who is 106. He was a propeller expert in the 69th. And he had a second hip surgery today. He had the first one 2 years ago, and he fell Saturday in the facility where he lives. And he had a surgery today at 4:30 y'all's time back east. And he came out of the surgery with flying colors, as only a tiger would do.
Nice. Wow.
And so we're planning his 107th birthday party for June.
Ah, that's amazing. That's so cool. That's so cool.
Thank you. He just, yeah, a little sweet Bill on, and he's a sweetie pie and just amazing. And when you sit and talk to him about propellers, it's like, oh my gosh.
See, that'd be fun, getting a little 5-minute interview with him for the show.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If you could.
I can see if I can record him.
Yeah.
And ask him some questions about the different propellers, yes, like the P-40 and other planes, and see what else. When you were asking me, Max, I have 1,004 stories, and I didn't give you a story on what they did. But one of our guys was tasked with redoing, Chenault gave Chiang Kai-shek an airplane. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember which model it was. It wasn't a fighter. It was not a bomber. It was a cargo type plane. And he was tasked with redoing the entire interior of the plane. And right before Chenault gave it to Chiang Kai-shek, they were still in there fixing it. And he said the one thing that did not work was the left windshield wiper blade. And they presented it to Chiang Kai-shek anyway. And later they found out that Chairman Mao shows up with the plane that Chenault gave to Chiang Kai-shek, and it was the right windshield wiper blade didn't work. And Irv said, "There's my plane." And then when I went to do research at Hoover, there were two letters, one from Chiang Kai-shek and one from Chenault to somebody else, thanking him for the plane for Chiang Kai-shek.
Oh, wow.
And I copied the letters and sent them immediately to Irv in Florida, who's 95 now, I think, or 96. And he was so thrilled to receive those letters.
Oh, I bet. Oh.
You know, there's all kinds of stories like that. Anyway.
So Charlene, actually, my recorder is still rolling.
Oh, no.
No. But.
Okay, use whatever you like. It's fine with me.
Okay.
If it is still rolling, there is one story about a pilot, a P-40. His name is Wayne Whitey Johnson. He flew P-40s in the 23rd Fighter Squadron, of not the AVG, but the 14th, which now is stationed out of Moody Air Force Base. They're called the Legacy Squadron of the Tigers from the AVG. And he told me when I went to interview him in Wisconsin, Minnesota, sorry. When I went to interview him, I said, well, what scared you? And he said, when I went, my plea 40 was hit and it was going down. And he says, and I kind of searched for a road where I thought I could land okay. And I looked down and I saw this road and I thought, oh, I'll be just fine. And he says, and I go to land and he says, and then all of a sudden I see these two pillars and I'm thinking on either side of the road and I'm thinking, oh my gracious, are the wingspan going to get through here? And he says, before I could even think that, one wing got flipped off. The plane wimped in a circle. The other wing got flipped off. And he says, and the plane flipped over. And he said, and there I was. And these Chinese people were coming out of the villages to help save me. And the Japanese were hot on my trail. And they put me in a pond with a rice reed and told me to suck on it to get the air. That's how he survived.
Wow.
Yeah. And I love Wayne to pieces. He's writing another book. His first book is From Farm Kid to Flying Tiger to Attorney. And he won two cases, one before the U.S. Supreme Court and one before the Minnesota Supreme Court in his law career. And he's writing a second book on being a flying tiger.
We didn't get to talk about your books.
No, but that's okay. My books are varied.
They do. They span a lot of different topics.
Yes. One's on grief and loss called A Hole in My Heart. And I wrote that after the suicide of my brother to help people learn to grieve. And then the other ones are two children's books. I've written a number of books for corporations through my consulting practice. And I'm writing one now called Upleveling and Communications for Corporations. And then I'm writing the one that I'm doing the documentary with, The Forgotten War, China, Burma, India.
Yes. I don't know how you have time for all these things, Charlene.
Well, I just make it.
A woman doesn't sleep.
Yeah.
I don't. And that's one of the challenges, but it's okay because the clock is ticking, gentlemen. And we're losing more of these men every day.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I just can't. I have to keep my promise.
Well,
I made a promise to my dad and his buddies and the board of directors of the 69th Buddy Squadron, as they called themselves, that I would do five things. And this is the last of the five things I promised.
See, and this is so similar to what John Mollison is doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Airplane Geeks art historian, and he has his show called Old Guys and Their Airplanes. And he's an artist, so he draws their airplane, but then he records their story and he makes a short film out of it. Usually, what, max 15, 20 minutes in length?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
How exciting.
Yeah, because he's...
Has he interviewed Whitey?
I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Wayne would be a really good one for him to interview. Because he's articulate and bright and loves his planes. He speaks. He had to have a surgery about 4 or 5 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And on his heart. And while he was on the operating table, something went wrong. Mm. And they ended up having to amputate both legs above the knees.
Oh, my God.
And the worst part about it was for him, as he told me, because we talked about things that change our life along the way, illnesses, injury, whatever. And he said that the worst thing for him was that he would not be able to fly again. And he was one of the co-founders of the Flying Tigers 14th Air Force Association and has won all kinds of aviation awards. And I just, my heart went out to him. And then we had our tiger dads taught us, you don't quit. You don't know the meaning of stop, or you don't know the meaning of give up. You just keep going, and one day it'll all be better.